coming up on This Week in Radio Tech. We're going straight to the moon. Well, not quite. Rocket telemetry, radio telemetry, is our topic today with Cornelius Gould. It's a little off topic, but it's radio and it's pretty fun. It's coming up next on TWRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, keeping you connected with your community with support and webinars, online at nautel.com/webinars. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. There it is right there. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and so glad to be here. It's a Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock Central Time, 5 o'clock on the East Coast. And this is the show where we just talk about this stuff that has to do with radio broadcasting. And that includes a lot of things. I mean, anything from putting a dime or a penny on the tone arm to keep the record from skipping, all the way fast forward to digital technologies and transmission schemes and internet. And today we've got some really interesting radio telemetry things to talk about. That is coming up with our guest, and I'll introduce him in just a moment. Unfortunately, Chris Tobin can't be here today. He's in a COVID-19 meeting at work. So they're working out procedures for getting people back together. Maybe he'll have a report for us next time. Before we get into our guest here, I want to make a quick announcement from my friends at Nautel. They have a new ebook that's out and available. I made a black and white copy of the front of it. 9 mistakes to avoid when buying a transmitter. 9 mistakes to avoid when buying a transmitter. I would highly suggest checking this thing out. Here's what you do. Well, first of all, Transmission Talk Tuesday. Yes, Nautel is still doing that. They're extending it into August because the response every week has been so good. These are roundtable discussions, and that means you get to participate. It's not a one-to-many sort of thing. It's not a lecture, although they do have expert guests on. You get to participate because it's a roundtable. To register, it's easy. Go to nautel.com/webinars. Nautel.com/webinars. You can see the topics there, and to register. The big news this week, Nautel has just published this ebook entitled 9 Mistakes to Avoid When Buying a Transmitter. That's geared toward both general managers and engineering managers. It discusses details that could be overlooked during the decision-making process and questions that you need to be asking yourself, need to be asking other people who you work with, and perhaps even asking the salespeople or company that you're thinking about buying a transmitter from. Here's how you get this ebook. Go to nautel.com/9-mistakes. So 9 mistakes with a hyphen in there. We'll put that link in the show notes. You can download this ebook to avoid the 9 common mistakes that can add to your costs and delay installation. And I'm looking over these here. These are good things. Some of these I would think of. Some of these I maybe wouldn't think of. So it's a good book to have. You can download. I registered for it and downloaded it from their website just a couple hours ago. 9 mistakes to avoid when buying a transmitter. They'll send you a link to the PDF. You can read it on your computer. You can print it out, and you can save color ink if you really want to, like I did, because I'm a cheapskate. There you go. Thanks, Nautel, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, and we're glad to make these announcements for you. Don't forget the webinars, nautel.com/webinars. All right, let's bring in our guest. I've heard him chuckling a bit in the background because he knows the score. He knows he's a radio engineer, or has been. He's a has-been radio engineer. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my friend Cornelius Gould. Hey, Corny, welcome in.
Hey, Kirk, how you doing? Nice I'm being good. On the show with you again.
Well, and where are you? You're on some kind of a television podcast set, looks like.
Actually, we haven't gotten much into television podcasts on our end, but it is my studio for the podcast that I do, bi-weekly podcast with other Rocketeers called The Rocketry Show. And you can find it at therocketryshow.com. So that's where I am. And we have our sister podcast, modelrocketshow.com, which is a show that starts with all the Estes rockets that you can buy in the store and fly them in the park and all that. And then The Rocketry Show is all about the advanced stuff that Rocketeers are doing these days and part of what we're talking about now.
Okay. Well, we're going to get into that. I want to, for those people who don't know you, and I've known you for, yes.
probably close to 20 years. I met you in Cleveland, yes. Ohio, I believe, at what, the CBS mm-hmm. stations? Yeah. What were you doing there?
I was their senior staff engineer for the CBS cluster in Cleveland. I did that. I was there for about like 10 years or so. Before that, I was a Telos customer support. So we may have like initially brushed, you know, paths in there or in the mid-90s or so. So yeah. There you go. That's the early part of me with the radio stuff.
And then from CBS Radio in Cleveland, you came on board the same company that I work with.
Yes, at the Telos Alliance, and working with Frank Foti, developing the Omni 11 audio processor with him and the rest of the team. And moved on to other things after that. And these days, I'm doing the podcasts and also doing a bit of radio engineering again as a contractor these days for John Carroll, WJCU here, and doing some work with the station down close to me as well. So.
You and I have done some shows specifically about the G-force algorithm, which is a whole set of algorithms and topology yes. that you came up for to improve or to upgrade or to give a different sound to the Omni 11 audio processor. And yes. I want to tell you what impressed me. My biggest takeaway from that is that most audio processors have, you know, a section here and a section here and a section mm-hmm. here. And each section does a thing, right? Multiband yes. this, multiband yes. limiting that. And you said, you know, these sections need to talk to each other. So that yes. if one of them's working really, really hard, maybe you can tell the guy before it, I'm working really hard. It may sound better if you kind of step in and do your part. So you came up with this overall management scheme to manage the different people, the different, because I think of them as people, right? Because when yes. a lay person says, hey, Kirk, how does an audio processor work? Well, in the front of it, there's a little man with a volume control, and he's really old. He's old and slow and sleepy. And, you know, if the music gets too loud and starts bothering him, he just reaches up and turns it down a little bit, you know. And if it gets too – if he can't hear it anymore, he turns it up a little bit. And then the next guys are younger guys. They're adjusting the sound a little faster, you know, turning it up, turning it down, whatever it needs. And then the limiter guys, the guys that are in the multiband limiter, there's like five or six of them. These guys are on a combination of cocaine and speed, and they're working their volume controls really fast. So or, that's not exactly how it works. But anyway, you figured out a way to manage all these guys.
Yes. Or another way to put the guys in the back, for those of us old enough to remember the Little Rascals, where the episode where they're in the radio station with the sound engineer, you know, this the guy on the control, and if it's loud enough to make his hat fly off and his hair shoot up, then he's got to turn it down.
I missed that. Oh, I gotta see that. Oh my gosh, that's a real Little Rascals episode.
Yeah, the Little Rascals were on the air at a radio station, an old 1930s radio studio, and they kept doing things loudly that would cause the main engineer, the soundboard engineer guy, to react in ways like, oh, and his hat would fly off and his hair would be shooting straight up because it was so loud, whatever they're doing.
I wonder if that's on YouTube. I got to look that up. My mom and my dad used to watch Little Rascals when they were kids. Wow. Okay. So we can talk about algorithms, but I want to give people a sense of what you did. You have this broad understanding of audio and how it's supposed to sound, but more important than that, your background as an engineer informs you as to, you know, all kinds of technologies, including telemetry over radio waves, you know, radio telemetry technologies. Yeah. And kind of, you know, how did you get into radio telemetry?
Well, let's see here. I've always been had the general fascination with the radio in general, which got me into the business at hand. But basically, as I was getting back in the to rocketry back in 2009 after being away since I was a teenager, I was suddenly became aware of how far advanced the hobby became. And in particular, became aware of all these levels that you can qualify beyond just a person who flies the rocket in the park. So when you buy rockets at Estes and to fly in your little park, that's like level zero. And then the next level up is level one, where you get these more powerful motors. And level zero means you could fly motors from half A's to A, B, C's, and D's all the way up to about a G motor. Level one allows you to fly G motors up to H. And then level two is H to K motors, I believe. And then level three is everything above that. So as you get more and more powerful motors and bigger rockets, you go higher and higher. So I'm watching level two people launch rockets, and they're going 2 miles up, 3-4 miles up. So no matter how big your rocket is, once you get beyond a mile, you can't see them. So at that point, people are looking and staring at the sky, waiting for, you know, some sign that everything went well, or waiting for it to come back down. The people who fascinated me were the ones who had those Falcon trackers, where, you know, they've got the Yagi antenna and their point waving in the sky. And, you know, the launch control guy would say, where's your rocket? And they'll wave it around until the signal gets strongest and they'll point where it is. And I was going, that's cool. I wonder if I could take it to the next level if I ever get to that point. So that got my mind rolling as to, you know, what I could do with the things I've learned to make it a fun hobby for me and take it to the next level for me.
We're going to look at pictures in a few minutes of some of the systems that you've built, and you've designed some of your own systems and glommed onto that commercial off-the-shelf parts as well to get the communications. Yes. So we're going to look at that in a few minutes, not just yet, but I'm curious about one thing. So I guess a lot of people who are into model rocketry design a lot of their own things because maybe there's nothing commercial out there that exists. Mm. Now I'm a little bit into drone flying. And of course, when you buy a drone, you buy a $600 or $1,000 or a $2,000 DJI drone, it comes with lots of things to do telemetry. The GPS coordinates of where the drone is. You get video from it. It even records
and uploads to the web somewhere,
your flight path. So that, you know, anybody with access to that would know, he flew 412 feet above ground instead of 400. So all that, it gets to be available. A little creepy, but okay. I guess what I'm asking is, isn't there just off-the-shelf kit that you can buy and stick into your rocket? Why are you having to design a lot of this yourself?
There are off-the-shelf kits. A lot of them tend to happen in parallel with what I'm doing. So by the time I design it, somebody's come up with something you can buy. Two reasons. One, I want these things to be in all my rockets that I'm flying. And the off-the-shelf stuff tends to be pretty pricey. So an equivalent system to what I'm designing would be about $400 of worth of gear per rocket. So that'll add up really fast. So whereas I can, you know, build it, you know, for a fraction of that cost, as most any engineer that's known that has a knack for building custom things for their radio stations would know. It's just a matter of, you know, time, and it's fun, you know, and it also allows me to expand. It forces myself to push the boundaries of what I know and learn more and open up the possibilities to do even more. And that's a spirit that's in the hobby that I like. So everyone that's into the rocketry, they bring their particular talent in. So there's a guy that does auto body finishing. And he's can, you know, he'll design a rocket just like anybody else. But he designed a couple of rockets, one of which was a 10th scale Saturn V. So it was 36 feet tall. And it was for the longest time, the world record for the largest model rocket. And he launched it in Maryland. But because he's got this experience with, you know, doing auto body work, he made the thing look pretty immaculate. It looked like a NASA rocket in miniature. And in fact, after he flew it, NASA wanted it for display, and they have it now. And they send it on tours to show people a Saturn V using a rocket he flew in Maryland. So that's another example. I'm into electronics and stuff, so I bring my, you know, knowledge in electronics and radio into the hobby for what I do. And other people are great painters, and they can make a rocket with a beautiful finish. And other people are just really good at making aerodynamic designs and can make all kinds of, you know, rockets that look like they'll never fly, but they fly great because, you know, they're into that. And in our other segments where you actually have people who work at the NASA centers who come in with the hobby and have fun with the, you know, the rocketeers as well.
It brings me back to thinking about my own days as a kid, flying Estes rockets, building the kits and shooting them off. And I was just using the A motors. I think I probably built something that used B and C motors as well. Does that sound right? Would a 13, 14-year-old
yes.
could be using? Okay.
Yes.
A, B, and C motors. Yeah. But, mm-hmm. but you mentioned the guy who was actually his full-time job was auto body, and he built a beautiful Saturn V replica with a 10th scale. I'm thinking, with my experience, you know, the thing's going to crash and need to be repaired. So auto body would be the right background to have.
Yes.
Repair. Try to avoid avoid that.
Yeah. Yes.
So during today's show, we got a number of engineering things we're going to go through. I'm going to give you a chance to really talk about your rocketry flight computer. That's a key. I mean, that's really what you've built. And around yes. that rocketry flight computer, you have transceiver, you have RF portions, GPS, antenna mm-hmm. design goes into this.
Yes.
You're looking at what they call LoRa technology, L-O-R-A technology. And then you've got to worry mm-hmm. about things like weight. I mean, a gram yes. or two can make an important difference. So,
yes.
Yeah. All that's coming up. Corny, right now, I want to talk about a guy that both you and I know. He now owns a company called Angry Audio. You know Mr. Dosh. Ah,
yes. Yeah, Catfish. Mr. Catfish.
And yeah. And the folks at Angry Audio have now fully own the Studio Hub line and the Studio Hub name. And here's what's even better. The Studio Hub equipment is now on sale, but you got to use a promo code when you order it or buy it. It is GetReal20, and you get 20% off all genuine Studio Hub products. Now, if you're one of these people that looks to save money, and hey, well, we all are. We all want our budgets to come in under budget, our spending to come in under budget. You may have looked at some of the unfortunate knockoffs of Studio Hub technology, and I'm talking about things like, anything Studio Hub, but, you know, my favorite things are these. These are the Studio mm-hmm. Hub cable adapters that go plug into the equipment that you have and then go into a RJ45 socket, and you plug your cable into here, your Cat5 cable, and run that however long you need to run it. It's got great common mode rejection. You may need to just put a little 1 foot cable on there or put a long cable on there. This particular mm-hmm. Studio Hub adapter, male XLR, of course, they have them with female XLR. Here's one that's got quarter inch tip ring sleeves that might plug into your Marshall amp or, you know, whatever you got. Hey, and if you've got an AES device, maybe you just need a little single one like this. So you can go into an AES digital input on a piece of equipment coming out of a piece of gear. Whatever Studio Hub you need, it's now priced basically the same as the El Cheapo knockoffs. And you wouldn't want you really wouldn't want some trusted, respected engineer friend to come into your place and see your really cheap knockoff stuff. Don't do it. Just get the real stuff. Right. The real stuff is made with nice, really nice strain relief. The people at Studio Hub developed a fantastic system for injection molding the whole thing right here. Good, safe, secure. These things don't fail. I've had hundreds of these, and every one of them works fantastic. It's one of the things I can truly count on. I can't count on myself to make a cable. I may have to make it twice, but I can count on the Studio Hub gear. Use the promo code GetReal20 when you order Studio Hub. Talk to your dealer. Say, I want my 20% discount. And use GetReal20 to get your 20% discount. That's going to put Studio Hub right in line with the pricing of the knockoff products as well. You can see the website, angryaudio.com. You can pre-choose the Studio Hub things that you need. And if you've got older Studio Hub gear, audio consoles, distribution amps, and so forth, those are still being serviced with all the parts that are available. So check them out. Studio Hub, if you need some support, call or email to Studio Hub, and they'll help you out. But when you place your order, ask for genuine Studio Hub gear. Thanks a lot, Angry Audio, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And thanks for the Studio Hub gear. I love this stuff. Wireless
yeah,
studios,
much is quite a few. Quite a few of them in this studio here as we speak.
Really?
I've got the whole LiveWire thing in here, a little radius board and everything. So I've got Studio Hub stuff going on in here too.
You got more than I got. I mean, I use the Studio Hub adapters, but I don't have a radius board in my studio right now. They're all at my radio stations. So, okay. Let's talk. The key thing that you've told me about is the rocketry flight computer, and we add stuff onto that. Mm-hmm. So let's do a little show and tell. Tell us what the flight computer is and what it does. Why does a model rocket need a flight computer? Mine never did. What are you special? What's the deal?
All right. I'll start generically with what the flight computer would do in general on any rocket. And what you do when you get into the higher power rockets, you're flying, like I was saying, you know, way higher than you would with an Estes Estes rocket. So you can, you know, be going, like for me, I haven't hit a mile yet, but I'm working on it. But you can go a mile, 2-3 miles up. And one of the key things when you go high like that is you don't want to have your parachute opening up at apogee if you can help it. That's when the rocket hits its highest point in flight. Because when if a parachute would open up there, you'll probably never see the rocket again. It'll just drift away into another county or whatever. So what the computers would do is when your rocket launches, they're constantly sensing things like the altitude of your rocket and all that. And you program them with what we call events in rocketry. So the first event would be what happens when your rocket hits apogee. So you can have the flight computer set off a little pyrotechnic charge that'll open the rocket and deploy a small parachute. So it'll slow down your rocket just enough and it'll fall more or less straight back down. Yeah, there's a picture right there of my rocket at apogee separated there. And a little and that little ball at the top there, a little fluorescent ball, is the parachute. And in this instance here, I have a device called a chute release that's sensing the altitude of the whole ball of wax there. So mm-hmm. basically, you let the rocket come back down, and at a predetermined altitude that you program into the flight computer, you say, this is where I want my main parachute to open. And at that point, it could set off another pyrotechnic charge and open up a different section of the rocket that will then deploy your really big parachute to bring your rocket down nice and slow. And you generally are set that, like, you know, anywhere between 600 feet or so to maybe 300 feet above the ground, depending on the characteristics of your rocket. And in that picture you just shown there, which was the rocket I did my big telemetry test with this past week on the 25th of July, I used a device called a chute release, which has its own little mini computer in it. What it does is it'll hold your parachute closed as a package, and it's mm-hmm. sensing altitude the whole time. And in my case, I told it to let go of the parachute at 300 feet, and it'll let go of the parachute, and it'll open up, and the rocket will come down slowly at that point. So those are what people mostly use these flight computers for. And along with that, you get the ability to have logging as well. So it'll record everything that's going on, what it did, into memory. So when you get the rocket back, you can download the data on the computer, and it'll graph out, you know, how high the rocket went, how fast it was going, and things like that. So that's at its core what the typical rocket flight computer would do. And if you want to ask a question, or I can jump into
So it sounds like the primary thing you're really interested in is accurate deployment of the drogue chute at apogee, mm-hmm. and then deployment of the main chute. If you deploy now, of course, in my rockets, it would just deploy, you know, somewhere up there. Maybe it was still going up. Maybe it was falling down. Then it would deploy way up there, and it would float and float and float to the farmer's field, past the school, past the church, past the dairy, over to the next town, and finally land. And then we had to all run as kids to go find the rocket.
That's another thing. Yes. And you made a point too that's nice with the flight computers, in that when you're selecting a motor, and it's hard for a lot of beginners to do this, but you hang around with enough old timers and you get the feel for it. There's a delay. You have a C6-3. So C6 is the impulse class, you know, that the motor is in. And that dash number 3 will be a delay between the burnout and when the charge in the motor will go off. And there's a little black powder cap in there. So the idea is to try to optimize the delay between burnout and when that charge goes off. And if you get it right, your rocket would just hit at apogee, and then that delay would go off and open your parachute. If you get it too long, your rocket would arc and continue on its way down, and then the parachute would come off. Or if you get it too short, it'll pop while your rocket's still going up. And one of the nice things about the flight computers is that they're monitoring all that. So I use the motor delay as a backup. That's going to be really long. So if something were to happen electronic-wise or whatever, where the computer dies or some wire comes loose or something like that, the rocket's not going to come in ballistic like a bomb or something. The motor mm-hmm. delay will eventually at least separate the rocket, and it'll tumble down at that point. That's another key thing that you pointed out when you're describing your story there.
How are these devices, the ones you've talked about now, the computer that's on board and the other, the shoot release thing that you said is a separate device, how do they determine altitude?
Generally speaking, most of them have a barometric pressure sensor on board. So they're determining altitude by the change in barometric pressure. And they don't have to know the absolute up height above sea level or anything like that. They're just sensing relative. So it'll consider sitting at the ground to be 0 feet. And once it sees that the rocket is no longer going up, it then says, okay, we must have made it to apogee. And then it does the first event. And then the second event is when your main parachute opens.
So barometric pressure, and hey, as a pilot, and there are plenty of people who are pilots who watch the show, barometric pressure is pretty accurate way. If you calibrate it first, it's a pretty accurate way to determine altitude. What about GPS, though? Because we're going to get into that, but I think you have some GPS capability on board.
Yes. So this is where I start to diverge a little from the typical flight computer, in that one of the things that I wanted to have that every rocketeer wants to have is a way to find your rocket easily after it's on the ground. It could be that maybe your rocket went down and you don't really, typically what happens when your rocket lands, you try to get a line on something. So you will look at the horizon and you say, okay, where I'm standing now, my rocket just landed here. And behind the rocket is this funny looking tree. So that's my line. So I'm going to start walking towards that tree. And I know that I'm going to eventually walk across my rocket as long as I keep my bearing on that tree in the distance or whatever. It could be a water tower. It could be a whatever. You find some landmark and you start walking that lines up to where your rocket is. Now, if you lose that point of reference and no one else saw that or it can help you, you may or may not find the rocket. So that's one thing. Another thing is when you're flying on farms, which we all are, because it's really the only area that you've got a lot of land for recovery space, the crops can really make it fun to find it. So it's not unusual to fly in a farm where, you know, part of the farm, they've got corn growing and the corn may be kind of high. And as luck would have it, you're the one that launches the rocket when the wind decides to shift when the parachute comes out and it takes it out over the cornfield and drops it somewhere in the middle of that. Then it's kind of an episode of Children of the Corn going through the stalks trying to find where your rocket went. Or even worse than that are soybeans, where you don't think that's a big deal, but soybeans have this innate ability to see a rocket coming and they'll open up their leaves just enough for the rocket to go in and cover them up, and it's like nothing ever happened.
I know what they look like. You couldn't find anything in soybeans. Oh my gosh. Yeah, you're right. They cover the ground with their leaves. At least corn has, you know, you got space between the rows. And by the way, when you're walking through a crop to go retrieve something, how much care do you give to not destroy any plants?
We give a lot of care because we're there at the benefit, you know, we're benefited by farmers who will allow us to fly on their property. And we try not to cause any damage to the crops or anything like that, because, you know, they're doing us a favor. And not very many people these days will say, oh, yeah, you can come out with your rockets and launch them on my land. Sure. You know.
Okay. I hear you. So now let's talk for a minute about this computer that does this. Oh, tell me about what's the barometric pressure sensor? How do you buy one of these?
Here is one of my flight computers. This is one that this is like my software development version. So all of this here will be stuff that will live inside the rocket. And I don't know if I can get close enough on the camera here. I do have a picture somewhere. If I get my orientation right. Okay.
It says back.
So this, So there's a little can right next to the capacitors here. And, my finger is going right about there. It's a little silver can, and that's the barometric pressure sensor. It's a tiny little thing.
And you're writing software that takes a reading from that. I guess you get a voltage from that, and you digitize that, and then you have to calibrate it against something.
Actually, it's sets out it sends data out I squared C. So there's a digital data stream with all that on there that you have to talk to it and it'll tell you the information you need to know. And then you have to interpret it into your software. So that's all the fun stuff. So that's what the barometric pressure sensors look like. And I've got another one that I'm going to be switching over to that's even smaller than that. So that's going to be fun. So you talk to that and you get the data from that and you pull it, you know, off, you know, quickly enough, to make sure you don't lose any data because the rockets, when they're moving, they'll move pretty fast. Mr. Bean, the rocket that I launched this weekend, that one, looks like it made it to about 200 some miles an hour peak. And that's fairly slow for a rocket these days. A lot of them would, especially when you're going up higher than that, you know, it's not unusual to hit Mach 1, Mach 2. On the way up. Really? So you've got to be responsive.
I got to ask you now, is that scale miles per hour or is that actual real miles per hour?
Actual.
Whoa.
So in scale, that'd be really fast.
Yes.
Oh, gee. Wow. Okay.
And hitting Mach has its own challenges when it comes to sensing barometric pressure because the shock wave will travel down the rocket. And once it goes across the sample port, it could trick the computer software into thinking it made it an apogee, and it's not. It's going Mach 1 and still going. It'll try to deploy parachutes
you don't want,
at that
velocity. You don't want ship deployment at Mach 1. It's bad for everybody.
So you have to write your code in such a way where, you know, it's expecting that and doesn't deploy parachutes under those conditions. So,
radio communications at you're, I believe you're using 2.4 gigahertz as your frequency band. It's in the Wi-Fi band, but it's not Wi-Fi per se. It's just in that band, which is available to use. When you know, line of sight is great. I'm sure you can talk a long ways. My drone is 5.8 gigahertz, and I've certainly successfully flown it at a distance of 2 miles. So that's about 11,000 feet away. Now that's in a rural area with you know, no other or very little other Wi-Fi around. But when my drone is down, you know, near the treetop level, my reception and control, I don't have 2 miles. You know, I may have a couple thousand feet or less. So when the rocket lands or when the rocket falls to the earth and
is on the ground,
it's out in the corn somewhere. Are you getting any signal from it typically at that point?
Well, I'm in the early phases of seeing just how robust it is. This past flight that I did, it wasn't too far away from things, but I had signal from it when it was on the ground. But what my system will do is at the point that it loses contact with the rocket, it'll hold all the values that it received from whether from the GPS and all that. So that at that point, you can at least type in the last coordinates it got from the rocket before the signal went out, with the idea being that should get you close enough. And to help with that as well, I've got these loud screamer devices on the rockets that will hurt your ears. It's like those personal protection devices you can get at Target where people can put on their purses and you pull the pin and it makes a loud noise to get everybody's attention. I use those in the rocket or rig them up in such a way where the pin gets pulled at apogee when everything deploys. So if you're relatively close to the rocket, the idea is hopefully you can hear that screamer going and just follow the sound from there. So get in the neighborhood, follow the sound.
After losing my drone a couple times, I discovered something that I thought would be pretty helpful. And assuming that the battery was going to run down and I wouldn't be able to find it, during the day, I put some very reflective striping on the drone. So if I went back at night with a flashlight, I would have some chance of getting a little bit of a hint, even if it was down in the leaves, I'd get a little hint of, look, there's something bright and shiny over there in the bushes.
I'll go there.
Recover my. No, they're not raising stripes there. Just they're help the old man find it late at night stripes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's really cool that it saves the last good data that it got. So maybe it got that, you know, 30, 40 feet above the ground and depending on what's between you and it, and then you lost it.
Right.
Well, you've got those numbers. It can't travel very far if it's, you know, just 100 feet off the ground and lands. Okay. That's cool. Well, I want to hear about the RF, but I tell you, we're going to take a quick break here and hear from one of our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to hear about the RF and how you've had to massage that to get good data back and forth and what software you've had to write. So we'll do that when we come back. This Week in Radio Tech, right. I'm Kirk Harnack. We're talking with Cornelius Gould. He's an audio processing algorithm designer. He's designed some of the most fantastic audio processing algorithms that are out there, even starting from an early age. Broadcast engineer and also a model rocketry enthusiast, and has designed a lot of his own stuff for model rocketry. He's really been into that. So we're going to keep talking to Corny here in just a minute. Our show is brought to you in part by Broadcasters General Store, and they represent broadcast tools, the whole line of broadcast tools gear. And one of those things is this cute and effective little mixing console called the ProMix 4. Now, this console is not for every situation, but it's for some situations, it's exactly what you need. First of all, it's durable. You can beat this thing up because, you know, Don Winget builds equipment that is very durable stuff and lasts. Oh my goodness. We got broadcast tools gear at our stations that's got to be 35 years old and it still works. Broadcast Tools ProMix 4 is a small mixing console. It is mono. You don't have to worry about panning. The idea here is to get voices back to where you need, whether it's just in the next room or maybe at a radio remote, a ball game. The ProMix 4 is a full-featured audio mixing console. It's perfect for most any broadcast studio, but also excelling in the remote broadcasting and podcasting applications. It has three microphones inputs, which can also be line inputs, so mic or line, as well as a dedicated line input that can be switched between a balanced line input and the internal USB codec. So that means you USB it over to your computer, and you can use one of the faders, one of the inputs, as audio from your computer. It also gives you a program limiter, because not everybody watches their levels properly, a balanced and an unbalanced mix bus, and a mix minus output. So you want to put a phone caller on the air, or maybe bring in a Skype call. You can do that and send proper mix minus back to the person at the other end of the phone or the Skype call or whatever you're using. It has three independent headphone amps with IFB and program pan controls, along with a comprehensive studio monitoring system. Lots of good things about this you're going to like XLR inputs we already talked about. It also has an XLR program output and quarter-inch tapering sleeve outputs and that USB output to connect it to your laptop computer. It can also drive multiple AHR1 headphone systems, so that's an accessory from Broadcast Tools. You've got a really complete system here for doing live remote broadcasts, studio work, and podcasting work. On-off controls on each one of these. And there's also a tally output, so you can light up that on-air light, which so many consoles don't let you do that. So check it out from Broadcast Tools, and the best way to do that is to go to Broadcasters General Store. That's bgs.cc. They got a website, but you know what I like to do? I like to call them at BGS, at Broadcaster General Store. They are there, you know, business hours across the country from the East Coast to the West Coast at 352-622-7700. Talk to any of my friends there, Jonathan or Hugh Jessica, Candace, any of them there. There's just a bunch of good folks who work there. Even Dave Kirsten. You could call Dave Kirsten, and he'll help you right out. Broadcaster General Store, thank you so much. And thanks to Don Winget at Broadcast Tools with the ProMix 4. All right, it's our 504th episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Talking to Cornelius Gould. And it's a little off topic from broadcast radio, but we are talking radio. So, Corny, take us through a little bit about the actual radio telemetry, how you developed that and what you had to develop in order to get telemetry back and forth to your rocket.
All right. So where I started with this whole thing was the whole experiment is how much power do I need to get the kind of range that I'm looking for? There are always the theoretical limits that the manufacturer of radio modems will tell you you can get. So I had to play that balancing game, you know, the amount of power, just enough power to do what I need to do. Because if you can transmit, say, a watt off your rocket and have no problem there, but that takes a lot of power, needs a heavy battery to do that. And that kind of takes away from what you can do with your rocket because you always have that weight penalty you pay whenever you're doing things. So it has to be something where the batteries are fairly light, but you can get the range that you're looking for. So the one of the things that's really revolutionized hobby aviation with drones and all that are the LiPo batteries. And here's one of the flight electronics that I'm working on for the test after the rocket I'm flying now is done. And that's the little LiPo battery over here, a little Turnergy battery. And I'm looking at the, oh, there it is right there. And, there is. And that one is, yeah, a little 300 milliamp hour battery, 7.4 volt jobby there. And that's the power budget I've got to work with. So with that, it drives a 60 milliwatt, radio modem, which in this case, the little XB, device there. And, so that's, you know, what I pretty much settle on, and that should give me a 2 mile range. And so far, but these rockets here are will make maybe a mile at the most. And so far, I haven't had any issues with that. But the next thing that, besides that was making sure that I get all the data and not lose it. And so the first flights I had were radio modems that and receivers, transmitter receivers had just whip antennas on there. And I figured it'll probably be an issue as the rocket moves around, but let's see how bad it is. So as the rocket would go up and it's, you know, getting apogee, and that was really the biggest problem because the antenna went from a vertical orientation to a horizontal, and on the ground it was vertical. So that, so at apogee, that would get a lot of dropouts, of course, with that. And I'm at the mercy of whatever might be bouncing off of whatever that might orient the wave back to vertical enough to get a signal. So it's pretty spotty. So what I was, what I've gone to are circular polarized receivers. So, this is the receiver box that's hooked up to my, radio telemetry receiver. It's got the little LED on there. So the, one of the cool things, and this is where your hobby and my hobby kind of merge is, with drones, people are getting, you know, wanting to get live video from their drones. So in order to do that, you know, you go wireless and, the drone, people learn pretty quickly that the best way to do that is with a circular polarized antenna setup. So that no matter what orientation the drone is in, you get your signal. So with that in mind, you can, you know, buy from the drone community nice little antennas for, you know, at the frequencies we work at. And this is one for 2.4 gigs and it's, you know, circular polarized. So, and this worked very well. It received the signal from launch to apogee all the way back down. And on Mr. Bean, the rocket behind me that flew, it just has a little whip antenna on that one. There's nothing fancy going on. In fact, on its electronics package, the little whip antenna is right here, sticking down off of the transmit. And that rocket was oriented all kinds of different ways, and then the signal was solid the whole time. It was always at 98% data recovery, so that made me happy.
Wow.
Now, for the next phase of flights, this is like the internal piece. And it slides into the outer covering of the rocket components where the antenna would sit in this little plastic area. And that's kind of like, think of it as the radome for the antenna. So right now for me just poking around, I just put this little whip antenna on the bottom of it. But for launch, I've got from the drone community another right-hand circular polarized antenna here that would screw onto the SMA connector here in the back. And this is the part that will live in the cowling. So now both the transmit and receive antennas are circular polarized. So I'll be testing that out and when this is ready to go. And I've got other antennas to play around, like the good old classic bat wing receive antenna too. So so that's kind of like the experiment I was working with antennas to make sure I get all the data back that I can. Because there'll be more things going down on that signal. Now you're saying about the telemetry data. I worked out a protocol that's pretty simple, where I send a start and an end delimiter so that I can tell, you know, if I'm getting dropouts in the signal and it's, you know, it misses the first half, but it catches the middle all the way to the end. My software can at least tell that, okay, that's a partial message. Throw that out. Wait for another start, you know, so look at the start marker and then read the array from there and pull the data out from there. And that took a while to develop. As again, I'm pushing myself that learning more newer things. So I had to come up with ways to make it so that the protocol is robust enough to be able to pick out, you know, if there's a data drop in the middle somewhere to know that there is a data drop, fill in what it can and throw out everything else and wait for the next line of data to come in to fill out the rest. So that was a lot of fun. We can go on and on for that with that for a long time. But But that was another test when this launch was, you know, if I lose any data, does it recover gracefully from it? And a little bit of that word loss, it did recover from that. So that was pretty cool.
At what point from the receiver to where the data gets logged or the data gets analyzed, at what point are you doing sanity checking on the data you receive? Because, you know, you could get a bad bit and data would be, you know, mm-hmm. way out of bounds from where it should be. I go for a walk, three or four times a week. Most of the time, my GPS tracker, I use a program called Strava, keeps track of me. But once in a while, if I go walk around a hill a little bit, all of a sudden it shows me at one point, you know, half a mile away. And then in a matter of seconds, I got back on the trail, you know, and we're not sanitizing our data here. So how do you sanitize the data that comes in?
The quick and there are a couple of quick and dirty things. The one is the nice thing about these XB radios right now that I'm using is that they've got the ability to do CRC checks between the transmit and receive, so they have another protocol going where they can tell when there's a break in the data or something's corrupted. And then on top of that, I do a check to make sure that everything is within range of what I expect. And if it's not, it just throws it out. Now, as far as other things like bumps in the data and all that, that I can get around with good old fashioned filtering. And mm-hmm. this is where my audio processing stuff really kicked in, and that these little sensors and even the GPS receive modules, they're fairly noisy. So if you were to look at them and graph out, you'll see all this noise jumping around. And in the middle of all this noise is the data you want, the altitude and all that, but it's like buried under noise. And when I saw that and looked at it, it's like, I know how to deal with that. It's time constants. So, so it's a combination of that and a Kalman filter that I use to smooth out that stuff to get the real data out of it. And the same thing can apply with the GPS, because a lot of that is just inherent in the system too. If you were to look at the raw data on the GPS, sitting a receiver, like when I set one of these receivers on the table and I just watch what it does, usually it's going to show where it is, you know, where you are. But there's a little error rate that's about like 20 to 50 feet where it might jump over here and then come back again. It might jump over there and come back here. It might show it across the street and, you know, so that's kind of where, you know, where another, again, where this filtering works out in such a way where when it does that, it jumps way out and comes back in. You've constrained how quickly you're going to display that, and it'll stay pretty much within the bubble of where it's at. So those are some quick and dirty tricks that I've learned to get around some of that.
I learned something today. What a Kalman filter is. I'll put that in the show notes, a link to the Wikipedia article, and if we can study that together. Hey, we got some pictures to go through. I'm sorry, we really hadn't gotten to very many of them. Can we buzz through some of these pictures and you can before we run out of time, you can tell us what we got here.
Sure.
Ooh, that's pretty. Look at that.
Holy cow. That is Mr. Bean on the liftoff. And one of the things I love, that's using the propellant that these rockets, the higher power rockets are using, is ammonium perchlorate, which is the same kind of stuff that the space shuttle boosters use and big NASA rockets for solid propellant. So one of the cool things I like that you can see in that picture are the bits of these little sparkly bits coming out, which is really like a nozzle blading away. The nozzle material, which always looks cool when I zoom in on a shot like that. So that's the rocket lifting off. And like I said, the parachute in this rocket lives in the air in that lower green section between where the fins stop and where that at the top of that light colored band, which is silver there. And the gray section of the rocket is where that the electronics live with the radio telemetry and sensing and all that.
All right. What's next? Oh.
Okay. So that picture there is the results of the radio telemetry receiver after the flight was over, and the rocket was on the ground. I didn't turn it off yet, so I just walked over and sat on the ground and looked on the screen. And so the rocket's sitting on the ground, so it's 0 feet currently, but the maximum altitude gets locked in once it sees it, 1259. Now, one of the things I've discovered is that the library I was using for my barometric pressure sensor does not have a routine to check the factory calibration on that. So I discovered in my lab here, you know, double checking what came back, that the altitude was off by about 200 some feet. So it was actually 200 feet higher than what the display is showing you. So that's something I've been working on since then. I've got that solved.
I'm sure you solved that. And I hope you solved the problem with the temperature, because that's pretty hot.
And now with the temperature there, that's from the outside temperature is about in the high 80s, 86, 87 degrees that day. And the rocket was sitting out in the field for a little bit, out in the sun on the launch pad for a little bit. So it was getting hotter and hotter on the launch pad, which isn't not unusual at all. But yeah, so it was a little toasty in the electronics bay. Then I have a.
See what picture's next here.
And then that's a zoomed picture of the launch there. That was the first time I've launched that particular rocket. My buddy Andrew, who built it, flew that many times, but that rocket flew straight as an arrow, and I can't wait to fly again. That was fun to watch. And that's the rocket in the workshop. I get a sense of scale there in my workshop. That was like a day or two before launch day. There's the antenna. Now on the, at my tent, which I nicknamed Mission Control, and my friend Andrew that I got the rocket from, he was manning Mission Control on the two-way radio, radioing to me out at the flight line what the data was coming in, which is kind of fun. But that's the antenna. It's on a pole. I try to get the antenna about 10, 15 feet up in the air so that the antenna can look down on most of the property. So when the rocket's on the ground, wherever it is, it has a good fighting chance of getting a signal even when it's on the ground.
That's a good idea. Sure.
And that is the electronics I was just holding up and showing you. That's going into another rocket, maybe later this year, early next year, for the next trial tests, where I start to, you know, do more than just testing the radial telemetry and the data parts of it. And that's actually having it control events. So that's what this part is being built to do. And you can see all the parts pieces laid out and in there with all my custom jumpers and all that. And the green boards are boards I design and put together. And if it's a different color board, that's something that's commercially available that I just, you know, plugged in, programmed them up, and wrote my software to talk to it all. And that's another, that's the software development board, which is, you know, the same stuff that's in the rocket, but it's a, you know, a little better shot there. And you can see the little square, rectangular silver device there just to the left of the two capacitors in the middle of the board. That is the barometric pressure sensor there. And it was fun learning how to do surface mount soldering too. That was fun.
I can imagine. So that the biggest board in there, that's of your design to hold all this together?
Yes, the large rectangular green board. And there's another green board that the GPS plugs into and all that. And the perf board on the top, that is emulating some of the other signals and continuity checks that it's looking for the pyrotechnic charges and all that. So I flipped the little dip switches to test my code to make sure it's reading that stuff correctly and triggering the right things.
Okay, I got two questions. Back on that picture, if you could, the XB module at the far right of that picture,
right?
That's mm-hmm. the radio. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. That is the radio modem. And on that day, I was testing out with just one of the generic ones with a little whip antenna. But I've since updated to the ones with the SMA connectors on it, so I can play with different antennas.
Now, so you've mentioned several times the word pyrotechnic, and that's a little scary to me. What do you do to make sure the pyrotechnics don't go off on the ground, on the workbench, when you're pouring over this stuff? What do you do to make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, you try not to pour them in over the workbench or anything like that. Basically, when I say pyrotechnics, it's basically black powder and electronic match, and they're in a little container. I use little centrifuge tubes. And what they're for is when you set those off, they pressurize the airframe of the rocket where the parachute is, and it forces the parts with the, you know, the sections apart. Same kind of thing that the Estes motors does, except the Estes motors use the fire of the launch. Well, the Estes motor is a huge black powder thing anyway. The propellant's all black powder. And it's just some loose black powder at the top of it behind a clay cap that deploys your parachute. So here, this is the way to have the electronics do that. And there's a whole safety protocol that we have in a hobby where your electronics are turned off until you get the rocket on the pad, pointed up, and then you turn them on. So in the event that something weird should happen and one of the charges goes off, it's not, you know, shooting a nose cone towards somebody in the crowd or another person at a pad or whatever. So they're pretty strict about that. And that's one of the things that keeps the hobby fairly safe.
Where do you put the on-off switch?
Okay, so I use, there's all kinds of ways you can do this. Some people use Hall Effect switches and all that. I use these little screw switches where you screw them down, and when the screw is up against the board, it makes contact between, you know, and it powers it up. And on the rocket itself, like that's on my stand here, there's a little hole here where it says arm, and the little screw switch is behind the hole. So you stick the screwdriver in there and you turn it until it bottoms out and it turns on. And that hole also doubles as a sensor port for the barometric pressure sensor.
Is that how Elon Musk does it too? Just like that?
You know, the funny thing is that so much of what goes on in big rocketry mirrors the hobby stuff quite a bit. And I didn't really realize it until we started talking to some of the vendors that that sponsor my show. One of which is Matt Steele, who is a professional rocket scientist, and they design the boosters and stuff that go on rockets. But for fun, he flies rockets, and he has a hobby company selling kits and supplies to all of us. And he was telling us stories how these little hobby altimeters and stuff are being used in, you know, they will attach them to things like the fairings to, you know, when the fairings separate and they get the fairings back, they read the altitude off of these little hobby altimeters to see what height things happened and how high they got. And so it's pretty funny how so much of what goes on in professional rocketry kind of mirrors what we're doing in the hobby, you know.
You surprised the heck out of me during our pre-show talk when you said that there's actually a rocketry enthusiast who's working on a powered descent and landing system for model rockets. Oh, my God. I mean, this just blows the mind. How does that possibly work?
His name is Joe Barnard, and his company is called BPS.Space. And he's been designing his own flight computers and things. And one of the challenges he took on is trying to get a rocket to land. He started off by designing IMU systems that can gimbal a rocket motor so you can launch a rocket without fins on it. And he successfully pulled that off so you can have a rocket with no fins on it at all, launch it, and it'll go straight up using his stuff.
Oh my gosh.
And he gimbals the solid rocket motor around just like NASA would gimbal a motor. And so his next challenge was to have, using a solid rocket motor, which is really hard, to try to set it up so his computers can time it in such a way where the rocket will fall pretty much down and then fire the motor at just the right time to slow it down enough to get it to plop softly on the ground by the time the motor burns out. So he's close. He's been getting really close to that. And I'll look at his videos and stuff that he posts and see how close he gets. And he'll, you know, publicly air that stuff live on YouTube and all that.
I'll put a link to his website, bps.space, in the show notes. So if you don't have a chance to go there right now, you can look at the show notes for this show.
Yes.
And you'll get a link there. Hey, Corny, we got to take a quick break. And when we come back, I will have some final thoughts from you, whether it's audio processing or rocketry, whatever we didn't get to talk about and you want to finish up, we will do.
Sure.
It's This Week in Radio Tech, our show number 504 with Cornelius Gould, just a great broadcast engineer, audio algorithm designer, and model rocketry enthusiast, and I'll call him an engineer because he sure seems to know a lot. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by my other friend. Yes, I have two friends, Josh Bone at Max Connect Wireless. This looks like an ordinary cradle point 4G LTE modem, and it is. But what's inside it in terms of the SIM cards are not ordinary at all. Sure, you can get a cradle point modem or any, you know, MiFi, that kind of thing, and get you some data. But that data is not going to be any more reliable than the local cell site and the number of people who are also trying to take up bandwidth on that cell site. The thing about MaxConnect Wireless is it's prioritized data. Now, you won't get 30 megabits up and down. You don't need that for what you're doing. You want to get audio or maybe video from wherever you are working remote back to the radio station that you're working at, or we've used it here for the podcast. And MaxConnect Wireless makes that happen because no matter how many people are using a given cell site, you get priority over everybody except for first responders. That means you can be at a stadium that is full of people in halftime. Okay, well, right now during COVID, it wouldn't be, but you know what I mean? You can be somewhere where there's a lot of people using their cell phones and you get spits and spurts of data. You get drop packets. I know I've tried it. I've been in Las Vegas trying to do an SBE meeting over video on a cell phone, and it looked like I had plenty of speed. And guess what? We kept getting lots of drop packets and it just didn't work well. But we whipped out the MaxConnect wireless. The speed was slower, but still enough, and we didn't have drop packets. We had a great broadcast because of MaxConnect wireless. So plenty of radio stations are using these now. Literally hundreds of these are out at radio stations right now, providing data service to transmitter sites, backup STL paths to transmitter sites, also good for remote broadcast. Take these out on the road and hook your remote broadcast kit up to this, and you've got 4G LTE data. You can get these with two SIM cards if you like. Josh has worked out agreements for prioritized data with AT&T, with Verizon, with Sprint, and also with a Canadian provider too. So you can get the carrier that you want. This one happens to have both AT&T and Verizon in it, so I can switch carriers to whichever one is working best at a given location. Here's the website, maxconnectwireless.com. Yeah, it's spelled goofy. It's spelled funny. There's a link in the show notes. If you're not in a position to write that down or look at it right now, just go to our show notes and see it right there. Single carrier prioritized high-speed internet service for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. It's designed by a broadcast engineer for us broadcasters. Thanks a lot, maxconnectwireless.com. All right, Corny, we're going to have to go soon, so leave us with a final thought. Whatever it may be, it's up to you. What do you want us to know?
Oh, man. Geez. can't wait for the next big test I have coming up.
What is your next launch, and what system are you going to be testing out with it?
Well, the next launch is going to be whenever the window opens up weather-wise at that field locally here. One of the things that's been a problem was COVID-19. So a lot of gatherings were suspended, and that meant that my tests were delayed for months and months, for a good part of this year. And the tests I just did was testing five or six different things all at once. And they were meant to be five or six different launches to test them where I can go through an orderly fashion, but the opportunity came up and I had all this code done. It's like, it's gotta be an all up test like the original Saturn V ones, to meet the deadline, just have to throw the thing in the air and see if everything works. Luckily everything worked, the testing was all, done. I just found that one little issue with the library. So, hopefully in the next month or so, we'll get another launch in where I can, do another test flight or two to see if this error in the library is resolved. And then I start to move on to the next test, which will be a different rocket that will be testing out more of these, the functions that I'm not even bothering with right now, like controlling the events and stuff like that. So
a lot of us got started with Estes brand model rockets, and I'm sure their website, and I will put a link to it, is full of information. But if people want to move up a little bit more from that, or look for local or regional rocketry clubs where they can kind of start to look at the things that you're doing, if they're interested in that, what's a good organization or website to go for that?
You can always check out NAR.org, the National Association of Rocketry. They're one of the national organizations that certify us rocket launchers and flyers and things. You can check out that website, and you've got resources there. There's another one, a Tripoli Rocket Association. They are the hardcore folks. Those are the experimental rocket guys and the ones that do a lot of the hardcore stuff like I'm doing. They'll even make their own propellants and things like that, and this stuff that the NAR doesn't do. So that's a resource for advanced stuff. You can certainly check out the podcasts that I do, where we talk to a lot of the movers and shakers and stuff like that. And so the show for the advanced stuff again is therocketryshow.com. And for beginner stuff, if you need to start from ground zero, because therocketryshow.com, you can pick an episode now and it'd be pretty daunting if you've never been in that advanced stuff. So the modelrocketshow.com is, get you started with easy to understand Estes level type, model rocket stuff. And you can go from one show to the other and learn more about that either through those websites or both through those websites and the shows that we produce.
So, man, I'm on these sites. These are great. I'm going to put these in the show notes. What great resources. And I'm glad they're all online here. This is really nice. Thank you for providing that resource for people who want to learn about this. So when are we going to see an Omni 11 in a rocket? Is there any reason to do that? Well, you said smoothing data. That's important.
Yes, yes, I've been using this. So I should point out too that Frank and I still collaborate with stuff, even though I'm not at full time at Telos Alliance these days. So we've been collaborating on some stuff too. So there's still some stuff for me coming out. But yes, the audio processing algorithms really came in handy in thinking of ways to smooth out all the data errors and things that just come out of left field on these sensors and GPS stuff. So it's funny how that all comes
together. Good deal. Well, good deal. Corny, I want to thank you so much for being on the show and providing these resources.
You,
we're going to publish the show on YouTube. By the way, if you watch or listen to the show on YouTube, and if you go to my website, thisweekinradiotech.com, or you go to gfqnetwork.com, and you watch or listen to the show there, you're seeing it from YouTube when you watch those places. You should go to YouTube and subscribe to the channel and set the little thing to alert you when we publish a new show. Typically, we publish shows on Friday after we've recorded the show on Thursday, but we'd like you to get notified that there's a new show out there, and that really helps us. And hey, if you want to comment, that'd be great. Comments help feed the algorithm, so we'd love to hear from you that way too. All right. Corny, listen, I appreciate again your time and talent and being with us. Next time, we'll talk about audio processing. How about that?
That sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you, Kurt. Right. It's been nice to be on the show.
Good deal. Anytime. And thanks to our producer, Suncast, for producing This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, home of plenty of other cool podcasts. That's so you might like it. Check it out at gfqnetwork.com. I'm Kirk Harnack for This Week in Radio Tech. We'll see you next time.